The BBC presents A Poet and His Public, a talk in which Robert Graves considers his relationship with the people to whom his work is offered.
Here I sit, alone in a soundproof room, at a table bare except for my papers, a pencil, and a glass of water. I'm supposed to be addressing my public. An awkward situation. The chances are that not more than one person in every 100 has read my poems even by mistake, except perhaps a few rhymes which I wrote nearly 40 years ago and which have got fossilized in school anthologies. The chances are equally against any immediate increase in the number of my readers because of this broadcast. You'll notice that the BBC have not supplied me with an audience to make encouraging noises and laugh in the right places, as they do for highly paid comedians. But a poet needs no audience. He can do very well without the giggle or hoarse laugh so necessary for the comedian. Frankly, honest public, I am not professionally interested in you at all and expect nothing from you. Please give me no bouquets and I will give you no signed photographs. That doesn't mean that I'm altogether untouched by your kindness and sympathy, or that I dislike the money which 2,000 or 3,000 of you invest in new volumes of my poems. All I mean is that these poems are not addressed directly to you, in the sense that the comedian's jokes are. But I don't in the least mind your reading my poems. Of course, I also write historical novels, and that's how I make a living. My original motive in writing them is usually to clear up some historical problem that has puzzled me. But I never forget that these novels have to support me and my large family. So I think of the average, intelligent, educated general reader and try to hold his attention by writing as clearly and simply and unboringly as the subject permits. Well, towards my poetry reading public, I feel no such tenderness. By this I don't mean that I have stricter standards in prose than in poetry. On the contrary, poems are infinitely more difficult to write than prose, and my standards are correspondingly higher. If I rewrite a line of prose 5 times, I rewrite a line of verse 15 times. The fact is that I could never say to myself, funds are low, I must write 12 poems, but I might very well say, funds are low, I must write another novel. Novels are in the public domain, poems are not. I can make this last point clear by talking about important letters. Most of the important letters you write fall into 2 different categories. The first is a business letter. Sir, I beg to advise you, in reply to your communication of the 5th ultimo, written with an eye on the office files. This sort of letter is in the public domain, but not the other sort, the personal letter, which begins, Darling Mavis, when we kissed goodbye last night, or Dear Captain Dingbat, you go to blazes. In each case, written to convey a clear and passionate message, and without any thought for a libel suit or breach of promise action, in which it may one day be produced as evidence against you. So with poems. We must distinguish those poems written with a careful eye to the public files from those written in private emotion. Of course, this comparison isn't quite exact. Although some poems, for example, most of Shakespeare's sonnets, are in the love letter category, and others, for example, a couple of the same sonnets, are in the you go to blazes category. Yet in most cases, the poet seems to be talking to himself, not either to his beloved or to his enemy. Well then, for whom does he write poems, if not for a particular Mavis or Captain Dingbat? Don't think me fanciful when I say that he writes them for the muse. When I say that a poet writes his poems for the muse, I mean simply that he treats poetry with a single-minded devotion which may be called religious, and that he allows no other activity in which he takes part, whether concerned with his livelihood or with his social duties, to interfere with it. That has been my own rule since I was 14 or 15, years old, and it's become second nature to me. Poems should not be written, like novels, to entertain or instruct the public, all the less poems there. The pathology of poetic composition is no secret. A poet finds himself caught in some baffling emotional problem, which is of such urgency that it sends him into a sort of trance. And in this trance, his mind works with astonishing boldness and precision on several imaginative levels at once. The poem is either a practical answer to his problem, or else it is a clear statement of it. And a problem clearly stated is halfway to solution. Some poets are more plagued than others with these emotional problems, and more conscientious in working out the poems which arise from them. That is to say, they are more attentive in their service to the muse. Although we know that Shakespeare circulated a few of his less personal sonnets among his private friends, he is unlikely to have had any intention of publishing the remainder. It seems that a bookseller publisher, one Thorpe, bought the manuscript of the sonnets from the mysterious Mr. W.H., to whom they were addressed, and pirated the whole series. Nevertheless, a poem is seldom so personal that a small group of the poet's contemporaries cannot understand it. And if it's been written with the appropriate care, by which I mean that the problem troubling him is stated as truly and economically and detachedly as possible, then they are likely to admire the result. The poem might even supply the answer to a pressing problem of their own, because the poet is a human being, and so are they. A poet's public consists of those who happen to be close enough to him in education and environment and imaginative vision to be able to catch both the overtones and the undertones of his poetic statements. And unless he despises his fellow men, he will not deny them the pleasure of reading what he has written, while inspired by the muse, once it has served his purpose of self-information. Young poets tend to be either ambitious or anxious to keep up with fashion. Both these failings only where poetry is concerned, because there are advantages in the business world and in most of the professions, encourage him to have designs on the public. The attempt to keep up with fashion will lead him to borrow the style of whatever poet is most highly approved at the time. Ambition has even worse results. The young poet will try to be original. He will begin to experiment, which is a great mistake. It's true that if an unusually difficult problem forces a poet into a poetic trance, he may find himself not only making personal variations on accepted verse forms, but perhaps, as Shakespeare and Hardy did, coining new words. Yet innovation in this sense is not experiment. Experimental research is all very well for a scientist. He carries out a series of routine experiments in the properties, say, of some obscure metallic compound and publishes the results in a scientific journal. But poetry cannot be called a science. Science works on a calm intellectual level with proper safeguards against imaginative freedom. And what's all this nonsense about poetry not paying? Why should it pay? Especially when it is experimental in the scientific sense. Poets today complain far too much about the economic situation. They even expect the state to support them. What social function have they? They are neither scientists, nor entertainers, nor philosophers, nor preachers. Are they then unacknowledged legislators, as Shelley suggested? But then, how can unacknowledged legislators be publicly supported by the legislature itself? I think that if a poet is obsessed by the muse and privileged to satisfy her demands when he records his obsessions in poetry, this in itself should be sufficient reward. Well, so much for the poet in his unjustified search for a public. Now about the public in his justified search for a poet. Public? The other day you sent me a one-man delegation in the person of a worthy, well-educated, intelligent, puzzled Peter Familias, who happened to be closely concerned with the publishing trade. This is how he began. "I must be getting old and stupid, Robert, but I really can't follow more than an occasional line of this modern poetry. I feel quite ashamed of myself in the presence of my boy Michael and his friend." I asked him to explain. "Well," he said, "when I was young and keen on modern painting, I had a fight with my father because he couldn't appreciate Toulouse-Lautrec or the Douanier Rousseau. But now an important Toulouse-Lautrec fetches as much as a Botticelli does. And if you own a Douanier Rousseau, you have to install a burglar alarm." Michael and his friends take the same line about Mr. X and Mr. Y, and so does everyone else at Cambridge. Mr. X's collected poems have recently sold 10,000 copies, and Mr. Y is regarded as the highest apple on the tree. All the critics can't be wrong. "Why can't all the critics be wrong?" I asked. "If you mean the unpoets who set the Paris fashions. Who decides on this year's skirt length? Not the women themselves, but one or two clever man-milliners in the Rue de la Paix. Similar man-milliners control the fashions in poetry. There will always be a skirt length. And, as William Blake said, quote, in a commercial nation, impostors are abroad in every profession. I do know that 20 years hence, Messrs. X and Y won't be as old-look as Humbert Wolfe and John Freeman, who were public idols 20 or 30 years ago. Well," he said, "Toulouse-Lautrec and Rousseau aren't old-look." I pacified him by agreeing that it would take an awful lot to kill either, or for that matter, Botticelli. Then he asked the question that I think you're all itching to ask me. How can you tell good poetry from bad? I said, well, how can one tell good fish from bad? Surely by the smell. Use your nose. He said, yes, perhaps with practice one can tell the clumsy from the accomplished, but what about the real and the artificial? I said, real fish will smell real, and the artificial fish will have no smell at all. He thought this rather too thick an answer, so I explained, if you prefer the painting metaphor, very well. The test of a painting is not what it looks like in an exhibition frame on varnishing day. The test is whether it can hang on the wall of your dining room a year or two after you bought it without going dead on you. The test of a poem is whether you can reread it with excitement 3 years after the critics have told you it's a masterpiece. Well, the skirt length of fashion has wandered up and down the leg from heel to knee since I first read my elder contemporaries, Thomas Hardy, William Davis, and Robert Frost, and my younger contemporaries, Laura Riding, Norman Cameron, and James Reeves. They have all at times written below their best, and none of them are in fashion now, but their best doesn't go dead on the wall. To conclude, the only demands that a poet can make from his public are that they treat him with a consideration and expect nothing from him, and don't make a public figure of him, but only, if they please, a secret friend. And may I take this opportunity for appealing to young poets not to send me their poems for my opinion. If they're true poems, they'll know this themselves and not need me to say so. And if they're not, why bother to send them?
That talk by Robert Graves on A Poet and His Public was presented by the BBC.